Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello and welcome to another episode of New Books Network. I'm Sharuni Dasgupta, and today we'll be speaking to Naomi Moland. She's Senior Professorial Lecturer at the American University of Washington. Her research and teaching focus on global media, international education, peace and conflict, LGBT rights, and the globalization of pluralist ideologies. Her recent book, based on her award-winning dissertation, is called Can Big Bird Fight Terrorism, Children's Television and Globalized Multicultural Education, published in 2020 by Oxford University Press. The book explores the dilemmas of localization, diversity, and tolerance on the Nigerian version of Sesame Street. Dr. Moland's current research investigates the cultural and religious dynamics of global LGBT rights movements. Her work has been published in peer-reviewed journals such as Comparative Education Review, Urban Education, and Global Education Review. Thank you, Naomi, for talking to us today. Tell us in a few words about yourself and how you came about interested in this project.
Sure. So I started my PhD after teaching for 6 years, teaching elementary school in the United States. I taught in Phoenix, Arizona, with predominantly Mexican immigrants, and then I taught in Spain for a year, also in schools that had significant immigrant populations. So for a long time, I've had interests in kind of how do education systems address diversity among their students, and how do they try to help intergroup coexistence and building national unity and tolerance and multicultural ideals and what and that kind of thing. And I was really interested in looking at that in other countries. So when I learned about the various international versions of Sesame Street, of which there are more than 30, or there have been more than 30, not all of them are currently airing, and that are viewed by more than 150 million children around the world in many, many countries around the world, I was so curious about how did their messages about, especially about peace and intergroup tolerance and diversity, how did those messages translate into different settings? And how did this kind of similar format of the Sesame Street model, that one of the main goals of Sesame Street since its inception in the United States has been about teaching tolerance and respect, mutual respect and understanding between different ethnic and racial groups, as well as religious groups and all kinds of diversity. I really wanted to see what that looked like in other countries around the world. So that's how I came to this project. I chose to work on the Nigerian version of the show, partly because it was new at the time when I was studying it. So I thought it was a perfect time to get in on the questions that creators were grappling with as to how to localize the program into the Nigerian context. And also I had experience in West Africa. I had lived in Ghana before and had a lot of interest in the West African setting. And so Nigeria was a perfect setting for me to kind of look into this project.
Thank you so much for that. Like you said, Nigeria was chosen as a site due to regional conflict and religious differences that were charging groups like Boko Haram, right? And Boko Haram literally means Western education is forbidden. So through this, the book also raises a very important question on how multicultural education can contribute to peace building. So can you also elaborate more on that? And if you could share the methodology that you've used.
Sure. So first of all, I would say, you know, as a bit of a, to clarify a little bit, I don't think that the show was necessarily originally designed to, you know, combat Boko Haram or as a counter message to Boko Haram, but it kind of happened that the first years of the show coincided with really the height of Boko Haram, when significant violence was happening in the northeast of the country, including, you know, that was perpetrated by Boko Haram, but also perpetrated by the Nigerian government. And the Nigerian government has been widely critiqued for human rights violations and for, you know, for example, rounding up people who look Muslim and detaining them extrajudicially. And there have been many executions and whatnot. So there's been, you know, widespread reports of human rights violations by the Nigerian government in response to the violence by Boko Haram. But as I was, when I was there, you know, it's sort of emerging, you know, one of the goals of the show from the beginning had been to teach, you know, ethnic tolerance and coexistence, especially because Nigeria has many divisions within it, as many countries do, between ethnic groups and between religions. So then it came into this interesting spot in Nigerian history and in the current events there, where part of what they were trying to teach was coexistence between Muslims and Christians in the country against the backdrop of extremist Islamic terrorism that was existing in the country. And that presented special challenges to the program, as you can imagine. Of course, the vast majority of Muslims in Nigeria were victims of Boko Haram and not part of Boko Haram themselves. But it was the issues of Boko Haram kind of, I think, in many ways, shaped the program and shaped how it was trying to teach tolerance and coexistence amidst a very tense national context that way. And yeah, as you mentioned as well, Boko Haram, the name Boko Haram, the way that it is often translated is Western education is forbidden. And in many complicated ways, I won't go deeply into the group, but, you know, they were an anti-elitist group, and Western education to them, from what I understand, symbolizes elitism in some ways and symbolizes the parts of the Nigerian government, both Christian and Muslim, and by everyone, who had really failed Northern Nigeria in terms of providing social services and that sort of thing. So some of the grievances around that definitely contributed to the insurgency by Boko Haram. So into that question, your question about kind of what can multicultural education do in regards to peace building, that's a very difficult question to answer. And one of the points of my book is kind of like, maybe not much. And I think we see this in many conflict affected societies, where we have enormous amount of hope that education can change everything and make a peaceful world. And sometimes we might need to kind of temper that hope by situating education in the broader social context where it faces enormous amounts of obstacles. And I'm not meaning to say, of course, that education and further developing education in countries is a bad thing or that it's not useful at all. But I do question some of the ways in which it's assumed to contribute to peace building. So, you know, the theory, I think, or the assumptions behind some of the work that Sesame was doing was, if we can help to build some of the creators that worked on the program, including Nigerian creators and American creators, because it was co-produced between New York's office Sesame Workshop, as well as many Nigerians in Nigeria who had an enormous amount of control over the show. Some of them saw that the show could hopefully contribute to children being more tolerant of one another and therefore less likely to be recruited into, you know, extremist groups or be radicalized into, you know, insurgencies in the future. Of course, that kind of thing is impossible to measure. You can't, even if the children who watch Sesame Square, which is the name of the program today, the Nigerian version of the program, even if the children who watch Sesame Square watch it today, it, and someday, you know, didn't become extremists or terrorists, it would be impossible to measure what effect Sesame Square had on that, because they are receiving many other influences on their lives, of course. And it's, of course, that would be such a longitudinal study, which would be tricky in many ways. But the goals, the beliefs was that at least, some of the beliefs were that at least Sesame Square could help to promote positive messages that could counter some of Boko Haram's messages. So Boko Haram said, you know, in certain ways that Western education is forbidden, and that, for example, girls shouldn't go to school, and that maybe no one should go to school. And although, again, Boko Haram's goals were wider than just targeting Western education, I think they did at some point begin, you know, kidnapping students out of schools and targeting schools and targeting teachers and students in complex ways that, you know, many people may be familiar of the kind of Bring Back Our Girls campaign that was in response to a particular kidnapping by Boko Haram of girls from a school. You know, so Sesame Square focused on, okay, we want to focus on the fact that, you know, promote messages that girls should go to school, that girls and boys are both equally capable of learning and should be able to go to school, and that learning is fun and that school is fun. And those were messages that were, you know, targeted towards the show's target audience of like 2 or 3 to 7 year olds, very young children. But they were against the messages that Boko Haram was perpetrating of that girls, that many children shouldn't go to school, but particularly girls shouldn't go to school. And then, you know, Boko Haram obviously was not promoting messages of ethnic or religious tolerance either. And so by promoting messages of ethnic and religious tolerance on the show, I believe that Sesame Square also was attempting to address some of the possible root causes of divisions between people in the country, and in trying to say, okay, how can we help to build peace and national unity using these tools of multicultural education? You also asked about my methods, so I'll shift briefly to that. I focused for this book on the production of the show. My research questions were really based around how do Nigerian creators translate this American model of multiculturalism via Sesame Street into the Nigerian context? And how do they grapple with the dilemmas of localization and the dilemmas of multiculturalism that will likely arise as they try to make that translation into the project? So it's not a reception study. I did not interview children or parents. I didn't really do research to try to figure out how the show was being received. You know, that said, I heard and read about that in different ways, but my focus of my study was really on how do these educators and creators who serve as these kind of cultural intermediaries between the United States and Nigeria, how do they make decisions when it comes to how to create a Nigerian show that has American roots? So I interviewed, I did in-depth interviews with all kinds of creators who worked on the show, including, you know, people that were like the executive directors of the show that had enormous influence on the show, all the way down to, you know, puppeteers and camera people and script writers and all the different, you know, a lot of different people who worked on the program, again, in Nigeria and in the United States, to try to really learn how they were creating this program and what kinds of challenges and obstacles they face and how they overcame them. So in addition to a significant amount of interviews, I believe I interviewed 72 people total. And then I did a follow-up a few years later with more people at the American, at Sesame Workshop in New York to learn more about kind of how the program was going and learn some about their other projects. I also did an episode analysis where I watched all 78 episodes of Sesame Square. And I had the theme song stuck in my head for about a year of my life, which is, you know, there's worse things that happen with research. So that was okay. And I coded them to try to really see what kinds of messages was the show including, related especially to diversity, multiculturalism, mutual respect, you know, religious tolerance, and national unity. And that episode coding definitely had a lot of influence on my findings as well, because I wanted to see, okay, how do these actually come out in the show? Another piece of methodology that I really liked the way that it turned out was what I called co-viewing interviews, where I would watch a short segment of Sesame Square with one of the people who'd worked on the program. And I would ask them, you know, what were the decisions that went into portraying Hausa and Yoruba children playing together in this segment? You know, what were the dilemmas that arose as you were trying to make those decisions? Do you like the way that the episode turned out? Would you do anything differently next time? And that really was methodology was very fruitful in really being able to get into the minds of the creators and see what they were grappling with as they tried to make the show culturally relevant for Nigerian children. And then I did also do some observations in classrooms around Nigeria where they were using Sesame materials, or they weren't usually watching episodes of the show in classes, but Sesame Workshop distributed educational materials related to the show, such as flashcards and a story mat and books and little paper puppets to, I think, 2,700 schools around Nigeria. So that was a major part of their outreach related to the program as well. So those were my main methodologies that I did to gather the data for this book.
Thank you so much. So many have grown up watching Sesame Street during their childhood. So how do you think a children's show can contribute to peace building?
Sure. So I think it is interesting to look at the American version, to start there and look at the American version and think about how when the show first came out in 1969, so it was almost exactly 50 years old when my book came out. It's now like 52 years, or I guess on its 53rd year, maybe for 53rd season. So it came out in 1969 in the United States and was very much linked into the kind of Great Society movement and coming off the heels of the civil rights movement. And it had an integrated cast. You know, from the first day, there were Black characters and white characters and Latinx characters and a character in a wheelchair and a deaf character, like from the very, very early seasons of the show, who were integrated, who lived in the same neighborhood, who hung out with one another, who were friendly with one another. And that was unusual on television at that time. Famously, it was banned in Mississippi when it first came out because it was seen as kind of a too explicit of a pro-integration message when a lot of the fights around school desegregation and whatnot were going on. So in the United States, the program has really grappled with all kinds of issues over the years and has done extraordinary work to grapple and tackle really complex issues in the United States related to, you know, over the years they've had, especially in recent years, they have a character with autism. They have puppets on the show who talk about their parents being incarcerated. You know, they've always had mixed race couples on the show and single parents and, you know, sort of showing kids that there can be all kinds of families. And again, you know, people with disabilities have been included on the show, people who speak different languages, you know, sort of showing diversity in all kinds of ways has been part of the American show's goal for the past 50 years. I'll just say a quick note here about LGBT characters on the show, because I think that that's been an interesting thing to watch. And it's something that I'm interested in because of other research that I do. And also because I have a son who's 3 and I'm in a same-sex couple. I am married to a woman. And so I've been thinking about this in a personal way for my own self of what kind of representation is there on children's media of same-sex parents. And that's something I think that Sesame has grappled with in some complex ways, including the fact that if they were to have an outwardly gay couple on the show, I think that could challenge some of their programming in other countries. So for example, you know, there's been the rumor since for many years, or you know, people joke about Bert and Ernie being gay. And a couple of years ago, you know, there was one of the writers who'd worked with Bert and Ernie who kind of said that he he had imagined them as gay, and he was gay, and he had thought about them in that way. And at the time, you know, Sesame Workshop, this was just a few years ago, you know, came back and said, no, you know, they're not gay. Muppets don't have a sexual orientation. You know, they're just friends, which was an interesting move. And I think part of that move on their part was that Bert and Ernie are on international versions of the show in many countries around the world. So if they did come out as gay in the United States, I wouldn't be surprised if that could get the show taken off the air in some countries around the world. So I should say that Sesame, since then, and even in the last couple of years, has had a gay male couple on the show. I think they were just kind of visiting the show. I don't think they're regular characters, from what I have learned. But anyway, I'm on a bit of a tangent there, but that's been a really interesting issue for me to watch with how the American version works with diversity. So just getting back more broadly to kind of like how can television, or how can multicultural television shape, build peace and build peaceful coexistence in societies. We know, you know, from a lot of research that multicultural education and diverse representation in media is important for two reasons, probably many more than two reasons, but I organize my thinking around this in kind of two ways. One, it's important for minority children, be that if they're in a religious minority, a sexual orientation minority, ethnic, racial minority, et cetera, to see themselves represented on television and in media, partly because that helps them to feel like they are a part, that they are normal, that they are a part of society, that they, that they're recognized, that they're represented, that they're, that the norm doesn't have to be and shouldn't be, you know, white, straight families or white straight males who are Christian, that other kinds of minority groups in the United States need to see themselves represented. And the belief that, so for them, we know that that's important. And then for the whole population who are not minorities or just everybody, it's important for children to see, again, the diverse groups that are represented in the society, even if those children are not a part of those diverse groups themselves. Even if they're part of kind of a more mainstream majority, it's important for them to learn about the diversity and learn about their society, with the goal that learning about another group and about their history and their norms and whatnot can reduce discrimination against them and reduce prejudices and stereotypes about them. And so we see that again in the Nigerian version of Sesame Street. Many children in Nigeria have little interaction. It's tough for me to even say that sentence because it varies greatly by region and whether you're in rural or urban areas, et cetera. But many children in Nigeria might not have much interaction with other ethnic groups because the ethnic groups are somewhat regionally segregated, right? So the north is predominantly Hausa, the southeast is predominantly Igbo, the southwest is predominantly Yoruba. Again, of course, there's a lot of mixing, especially in the urban areas, but generally it's very possible that people in many parts of the country will never meet or will not meet someone for a while who is of a different ethnic group or a different religion. So a goal with a show like this can be somewhat related to kind of contact theory. You know, in the 1950s, Allport talked about contact theory, which in a way is a very simple theory or a hypothesis that when you have contact with someone who's different from you, you are less likely to be discriminatory or oppressive of them. You're more likely to be tolerant and understanding of them if you've met someone or had contact with someone. So people who look at issues of diversity on media, and maybe especially children's media, think about that. If I've seen children who are different from me, and I can see that they have a lot of commonalities. So for a Yoruba child in Southwest Nigeria, if they can see a clip on Sesame Square of Hausa children, like there's a great clip at the end of an episode that I'm thinking of where a Hausa child, it's a live action film, so it's not puppets, it's actually, you know, it's children and their families. And the girl just says, you know, today my sister's getting married and this is how we celebrate. We eat special food and we wear special clothing and we dance and we play music and, you know, everyone, all families come together. She's just describing things that she would also have in common with a with people across the country, right? With people who are with other kind of ethnic groups that just show, okay, maybe we have a lot in common as well. Oh, look, I live in Southwest Nigeria and I'm Christian and I'm Yoruba, but I'm also at our weddings, we also wear special clothes and eat special food and have music and dance and bring our families together. So trying to also educate children about the commonalities that they have with people who are different from them might help to shape how they think about others in their country, and to kind of build peaceful attitudes towards them and peaceful understandings and more tolerant worldviews that way is a big goal.
Thank you so much. So good listening. Finally, how did you decide the title of the book?
Good question. There were some that did not like it. There were some who, you know, didn't want, who saw, you know, linking Big Bird to fighting terrorism as inappropriately political. I think Sesame Workshop strives to not be political, to not take sides or not align themselves too closely with political goals. And so to frame Big Bird as fighting terrorism in some ways, I think for some people kind of connected the show and connected the characters on the show in ways that they didn't agree with, as far as sort of, is Big Bird part of the US military? You know, is this linking somebody too closely to counterterrorism movements? I think also a lot of the counterterrorist movements from the United States, of course, over the past 20 years since 9/11, have been critiqued in many ways, including for igniting Islamophobia in complex ways, and for, you know, there's a lot of human rights abuses around the world that have been done in the name of counterterrorism over the last couple of decades, that many times have been disadvantaging, particularly for Muslim populations. The reason I chose to frame the book that way anyway, despite some of the creators of the show not maybe wanting to frame it quite that way, was because I did see this sort of fascinating coinciding of the program with the insurgency of Boko Haram, and the fact that it was beginning at the same time when Boko Haram was really very much at its height. I mean, it's still continuing to attack today, so it's not over by any means. But again, there were some of the creators of the show who did see it, I think, as more linked, of kind of saying, listen, if we can create more peaceful, more tolerant children and more better educated children. So not just that they're teaching them tolerant worldviews, but hoping that children around the country can also learn their alphabets and numbers and all kinds of important educational outcomes, with the belief that more educated people are less likely to participate in extremism or terrorism. That in itself is somewhat controversial in the scholarship. You know, most scholarship would suggest that more educated people are less likely to participate in extremism and tolerance, but that's not always true. But some of the creators of Sesame definitely believed that if this program could help to build more peaceful worldviews among children in the country and to increase education levels among children across the country, then that could help to contribute to peace and help to make children less likely in the future to participate in violence against other ethnic groups or other religious groups that way. And again, you know, I mentioned this before, but I also saw some of the show's messages, the Sesame Square's messages, particularly those messages related to, I saw some of those messages as directly countering the messages of Boko Haram, including messages promoting girls' education, telling kids that they should go to school, that school is fun, that school is important, that boys and girls are equal and should be treated equally, and boys and girls can both do whatever they want, and also messages about tolerance, which kind of and ethnic and religious tolerance and coexistence, which were direct counter messages to the messages that Boko Haram was communicating through its activities. And so with that framing, I decided to call the book "Can Big Bird Fight Terrorism?" to really interrogate these questions of what children's media in particular, but more broadly, what education can do to help counter extremism and build more peaceful societies.
Thank you so much, Naomi, for talking to New Books Network today and giving us your time. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. I enjoyed it.